Welcome to the True Sports Physical Therapy Podcast with your host, Dr. Yoni Rosenblad. Join us for a fascinating discussion with Dr. Race Hauser as we explore the application of dynamic systems theory in the rehabilitation of ACL injuries. In this episode, Dr. Hauser takes us on a journey through the principles of this innovative approach. We examine how the interconnected elements of the human body and movement system play a pivotal role in the recovery process, especially when addressing complex injuries like those to the anterior cruciate ligament, better known as the ACL. Whether you're a sports physical therapist, an athlete on the road to recovery, or simply intrigued by the science behind rehabilitation, this episode provides valuable insights into the dynamic and holistic nature of ACL rehab. Let's jump right in.
Back by popular demand was this conversation with Dr. Race Hauser, where we covered dynamic systems theory. Essentially, we get into what it is that dynamic systems theory is, how to use it in your rehab, and then specific points on when to use this concept. Dr. Hauser does an awesome job of really dumbing it down for the lay PT, let's call it, and really does a great job of not just explaining the background, but when you only have certain tools, when you only have a limited amount of time, and also where you are in the rehabilitation process following both ACL, and we also get into Achilles tendinopathy and Achilles tendon repairs. Race does an awesome job of explaining this very thorough concept, I would say, sometimes challenging concept, but makes it so easily digestible. So it was really a great conversation. As always, I encourage you to listen intently, take some notes, hit us with some questions, True Sports PT on Instagram, but also you can find Dr. Hauser all over social media. And we want to hear from you guys. And we want you guys to share this information with all of your colleagues, because our mission here at the True Sports Physical Therapy Podcast is to make you better at what it is that you do. So if there's more things that you want to hear about, let us know. Find us on Instagram, shoot us a DM. We're super responsive. Thank you so much for listening, for your loyalty, and for really your attention to some of these awesome concepts. Can't wait for you to listen to this conversation with Dr. Race Hauser. Welcome back to the True Sports Physical Therapy Podcast. Dr. Race Hauser making his third appearance on the pod because we get unbelievable feedback on your appearances here at the podcast. So back by popular demand, Dr. Race Hauser, you're going to tell us about ecological dynamics, sometimes called dynamic systems theory. That is a bunch of mumbo jumbo. Can you please define ecological dynamics for us?
Essentially, it's a movement framework that looks at how essentially the environment, the task, and the individual interact to form the movement that we see. So movement's going to be an emergent phenomenon. It also takes into consideration that humans and our individuals are a nonlinear system. So when we talk about this or describe this, essentially it's going to be a system where the change in the output's not going to be linearly related to the input that's associated with it. We will look to try to form patterns or attempt to explain things in more linear fashion, because I think it makes more of a conceptual sense that way. But the problem is that it starts to hide phenomena. Essentially, I'll relate it as like chaos theory, where like a small change in the input can result in a large or drastic change in the output. Essentially just by, you know, making some slight alteration in the condition of the movement or altering range of motion, et cetera.
Okay. So we like, as humans, living in this linear world, mm-hmm. where we give a small input, we expect a small change in output. You're saying it's not always like that, according to this dynamic systems theory or ecological dynamics. Mm-hmm. Those are one and the same, those mm-hmm. terms. So apply that concept where it's not linear to an ACLR. Let's use the example of a squat. You ask this patient, do a bilateral squat, a standard squat form. Tell me where this dynamic systems concept comes into play.
So I think one will break that down a little bit. So we're going to have kind of two routes for compensations here. We're going to have one that's going to be interlimb. So between limbs, we're typically thinking like a weight shift towards the contralateral side. And then we're going to have an intralimb compensation, which is going to be within that same limb. When we start talking about the interlimb, kind of alluded to earlier, it's going to be that weight shift. So I want to try to, you know, implement some sort of constraint or alter the environment to try to get them to shift over more towards that involved side. And we're going to have a handful of ways that we can try to get about doing this. First one is going to be some sort of visual feedback. you know, if we have access to force plates, essentially when we look at the curves as they're doing squats, want those to be able to match each other. A low tech option could be using a weight scale where it's like, hey, get the numbers to match side to side as you're going up and down with the squat. Other things we can use is posting the contralateral limb on some sort of implement. So let's say we put a 45-pound plate underneath the non-involved side to try to get them shifted over. Earlier stages, we could potentially use a Bosu ball or Eric's pad when essentially the load's not going to really, or the amount of load that we're using, that sort of unstable or more compliant surface is not going to detract from the overall movement. And then the last thing we could potentially consider using would be some sort of offset load. We kind of have two strategies here. One would be to essentially load the same side as the surgical side and try to almost pull them into that side. The other option would be to have the weight be contralateral to try to almost push them back, essentially like trying to get that center of mass more center in the middle of the base of support. Only thing you'll run into there is if the weight starts getting to be too heavy, that's probably going to end up pulling them more towards the contralateral side. So we may get to a point where we have diminishing returns.
Yeah. Okay. So these are external cues mm-hmm. that you're giving people. Apply it with internal cues. So you ask for a bilateral squat. What internal cue are you going to give them so that they live on the affected limb?
So like, let's say we have the mirror. I might say like, hey, I want you to match the right and left leg in terms of squat mechanics. Giving them some sort of feedback mechanism in terms of like, hey, I want these to look the same side to side. Same thing with the weight scales. Essentially have those scales register the same weight side to side. I want them to focus, at least in terms of the weight shift, focus less on what's happening, you know, at the trunk, at the knees, and more just being able to get equal weight distribution side to side.
Okay. And what are some of the compensations that you're going to see when you ask them to do this squat?
So aside from the weight shift, I would say the other big things we're going to see are going to be less anterior translation of that knee forward. So less knee over toe-ish.
Especially in a BTB,
yep,
right?
Especially
because of that knee pain.
Mm-hmm. And then other thing we're going to see is going to be a more of a hip dominant strategy. So I'm either going to see a forward trunk lean. I'm going to see the hip shoot back posteriorly or a combination of both.
So there's so many options there for the athlete to get away from the movement that you desire, that they desire. How do you dumb this down? Because I find myself when I try to cue a patient, I'll be like, push your knee forward, but also your trunk. But also I want your butt to sit back. How do you simplify this with that initial directive?
So I try to go more of the constraints to try to get at the movement that I want versus me trying to give a ton of verbal cues. So let's say I'm trying to tell them or cue them to get more of an upright trunk or shoulders back. And let's say that verbal cue doesn't work. I just want to put them up against a wall or the rack or the post of that squat rack. Essentially, if they lose contact with the back of their shoulder, they're not maintaining that vertical trunk. Same thing. If I want more a knee over toe split squat, I'm going to add in either a box or a foam roller as that sort of external cue to try to drive that translation forward. I feel like those are usually better means in terms of getting at the desired movements or desired kinematics versus me trying to harp away with just a bunch of verbal cues.
Yeah. Now, if those verbal cues are forcing the knee forward and they're feeling that anterior knee pain or donor site pain, how worried about that are you from a physiologic standpoint? Like, you don't want them to load that tissue because it hurts versus you got to get them comfortable doing that.
Mm-hmm. Especially with the patellar tendon grafts, I typically will treat that more as like a patellar kind of tendinopathy. So maybe in the very, very acute early stages, I'm probably less likely to have it be painful, maybe more on the terms of pain-free, maybe up to a 1 or 2 out of 10. As we start to get into some of these later stages, I'm okay if we start to push into more of a 3 or 4 out of 10 in terms of the pain spectrum. And then also monitoring that following day, what sort of flare-up or lack of flare-up, lack of symptoms that we're having.
And what's the grading there? How lenient are you with residual knee pain the following day?
Usually if we're having more residual knee pain the next day, similar to like patellar tendinopathy, usually that means we probably pushed a little too much that day before. So we might, depending on like the spacing of the sessions, if they're back to back, I'm probably going to regress that that session the day following. If they're coming in maybe a few days later, maybe I keep them at that same level and kind of build up some tolerance there.
Okay. How do you track that nuts and bolts wise? You see this patient on Monday, you do the desired squat, you do it through the lens of this ecological dynamics concept they have some moderate knee pain during the session. How do you get feedback on them, what it's like the next day? Are you texting them? Are you asking them to just jot it down? What have you seen work?
I'll say usually it'll depend on the patient. Sometimes I'll have them have like some sort of pain diary. It's like, hey, just jot some notes down of like what you experienced the day following. If it's someone who I know is relatively reliable in terms of being on top of like tracking symptoms, workload management, some of those things. If I see them on a Monday and then see them again on a Thursday, but okay, like tell me how Tuesday was, any knee pain in the morning, how are you throughout the rest of the day on Monday? So it'll be kind of a pick and choose depending on who you're working with.
Okay. Now, if we're going to say ecological dynamics and dynamic system theory are the same thing, I'd rather call it DST than ED. So if we're dealing, where do you come across this DST concept? Is it well-founded in the literature? And why is it so complicated? To me, it just sounds like it's compensation, patient compensation. What's the difference?
It largely comes from like the motor learning skill acquisition world.
That's your world, dude. You love that world.
And I think being able to then apply concepts from different sort of frameworks and modalities to try to give them the best sort of experience, because let's say I never live in the sort of motor learning realm, there's probably gonna be things that I miss. And same thing, like if all you ever do is just live in this like motor learning realm and never maybe, you know, start to dive into like almost like bodybuilding sort of stuff, where it's like we just grip it and rip it sort of stuff. I think there's like the sort of give and take where depending on like where your patient's at, like maybe you're more on the motor learning side of things. And then vice versa, you might have another patient who maybe you're more just like, hey, let's just get after it, get in the weight room. I don't really care about skill acquisition at this point. Like we just need to hammer away at quad strength.
And when you're first teaching the patient, this is the first time that they have bilateral squat. Let's say they were non-weight bearing to begin with. How much cueing are you doing before you see a few reps, or do you just let them move?
I just want to let them move. I want to see what sort of strategy that they adopt first. You know, are they trying to offload their knee? Are they trying to weight shift? Are they trying to use more of a hip dominant strategy? And then from there, it's like, okay, what sort of means can I use to essentially get them more comfortable with maybe a more upright position? You know, whether it's using like the wall as a constraint, whether it's some sort of anterior load with the goal of trying to like almost get them counterbalanced with more of a posterior shift there. So I think we have options to try to acclimate them to some of those movement strategies or build up some tolerance there. As a means to try to get a better movement pattern.
Okay. So you let them move, you decide how they're moving and what cues work, and then you just live there. Do you ever say DST to the patient? Hey guys, quick pause and a quick shout out to this new masterclass that we just launched here at True Sports Physical Therapy. Myself and Dr. Tim Stone put together a masterclass of ACL rehab, and we call it From Table to Turf. And the reason we call it that is because it's going to teach you exactly how to get your athlete all the way from post-op day one with the nitty-gritty of regaining all of that range of motion, with the tips and the tricks that we use here at True Sports Physical Therapy that gets our athletes better, faster, and stronger. And that's early. And then how do you progress that athlete all the way onto the field with a ball in their foot or a stick in their hand or whatever their sport is, and teach them how to accelerate, how to decel, how to change direction, and all the mechanics that go in there. What drills do we use to get our athletes exactly where they need to be, back on the field, and even better than before injury? And I want you to sign up for that class. Now, you can find it on our website. You can shoot us a direct message and just say, hey, send me the course. It's right now on sale, so make sure you sign up now. It is fully accredited to get you all of your continuing education hours. Sign up for the True Sports Masterclass ACL From Table to Turf. Thanks, guys.
No, I don't think I've ever said, unless it's, I do have one person who is a sports psychologist who I will at times reference like dynamic systems theory or ecological dynamics, because she does have some familiarity with it. But I would say 99% of my patients, I've never used that term.
Okay. And did you come across this term or way of thinking in PT literature, or it's just motor learning?
There's starting to become more of this literature, I would say more in the neuro world, more as it relates to like post-stroke, some pediatric populations. But I would say the vast majority of it comes from like just the pure motor learning realm in terms of like skill acquisition, you know, sports performance, those sort of things.
Okay. And if I'm a new clinician, how is it that you would recommend I come across these terms? How do I keep up with ACL literature and neuro literature if it's so important?
So my background's gonna be a little bit different. My undergrad class had a motor learning class. So I was exposed to this since sophomore year, we'll say 2016. So that's always been something that I've just like had in the back of my mind. You'll see a lot of other people in the PT world, like on Instagram or social media, posting stuff about dynamic systems theory. I think that can start to get the ball rolling in terms of just kind of understanding it from a framework standpoint.
Okay, hold on. Give me, where can I find that? Because that doesn't show up on my Instagram feed. So specifically, where should the listeners find information like that?
So two good people. One is Taylor Eckel. She's a PT out in the Pacific Northwest, out in Portland. And the other one is Shelby. I think the last name is Miller. I believe her handle is Rethinking Rehab. She also, I think, hosts the like Cal U podcast. I would say those are probably two big people who probably come to my mind in terms of like constraints-based like loading and being able to like implement constraints to try to get at desired movements.
Are you posting this stuff under your own handle?
Mm-hmm. So I think it's the post that I had maybe a couple days ago with the rack step down. That's the same sort of thing, like using that sort of dynamic systems theory to implement constraints to try to bias more quad loading.
As if not everyone that's listening to this pod saw that post, just describe what that looked like.
So I have someone doing a high box step down. Their back's up against a very large post. And I also have essentially the Met from the Met heads forward that is floating off the front of the box there. So we have some literature to suggest that when kinematics are the same side to side, that we still have torque differences in terms of quad loading based off center of pressure. And the involved side of the surgical side had a more anterior center of pressure. And I understand like the foot's not a very long structure, but in terms of center of pressure, it's going to be where the average sort of ground reaction forces are happening. So if I can limit ground reaction forces at the forefoot, like I'm more likely to have that shift more posteriorly to get a little bit more quad loading there. We also have the vertical post there to try to get at the vertical trunk to limit any sort of hip or trunk strategy. And then the high box to try to get at deeper ranges of knee flexion. And my patients were doing no weight, and it's a very humbling.
Smoked them. And so that's you giving external cues mm-hmm. to elicit the desired load or performance mm-hmm. that you were after. And that's how I would define, having had this conversation, mm-hmm. DST. Mm-hmm.
Yep.
Okay. Now, correct me if I'm wrong. The further posterior your center of mass is, the more quad dominant you're going to be. Mm-hmm. Would you agree with that?
Yep.
Okay. Why is that?
So if we take more of like a, we'll take a squat movement here. Essentially we have knee as our one like main axis that we're considered about in terms of the lever there. And if the more posterior load I have or more posterior center of mass I have, that's going to create the longest lever length, essentially going to create the longest lever arm in terms of creating demand for the quad to work against or the external moment there.
And that's the longest lever. Would the lever there be your tibia? What's the lever?
The lever is going to be the femur there.
Okay. So femur is traveling anteriorly away from.
So if we took a split squat here, I don't know if the viewers can see this here, but like as I come down here, like the femur is going to be the lever there. The knee is going to be that fulcrum there. Essentially everything's going to be moving about that in terms of the relative quad loading. Now we can adjust the tibia position to then also try to bias more of the lever arm essentially. So if we take that same position and I start to move the foot more posteriorly and get more of like an anterior or like knee over toe split squat, that's also going to be a way to get the lever arm a little bit longer as well.
Longer away from what axis?
When we look at where the center of mass is. So like, let's say the center of mass is like either their belly button, their hip, essentially where most of that mass is going to be located. That's where I'm taking that lever arm from or deciding how long that lever arm is. And we're just approximating that it's going to be roughly through like their shoulders and hips there.
So if it's through their shoulder and hips, the knee is traveling anterior, right? That's a longer moment arm away from the center of mass being the trunk, mm-hmm. right?
Yep.
So tell me why the weight in the heel elongates that lever. If the lever is when you're discussing the lever is away from the trunk. why is it heel and not toes? I would have thought toes. Now you have the lever running from toe to, let's say, trunk, which if it's against the wall, that would mean the force is in the toes versus the trunk as opposed to the heels, which is a little bit closer to the trunk.
I'm going to pull up a picture here because I'm going to try to describe this, and I want to give you a visualization here.
This is why I love this pod, because you're definitely teaching me.
So we have the, can you see this, Yoni?
I can see it.
Okay. Essentially, when we look at just like a regular double leg squat, imagine we have a little bit of like knee over toe, hip's going to be directly over the heel, essentially, as we descend down. If I have a more posterior center of pressure here, this back line here, you're going to see that creates a longer lever for the femur there, versus if that center of pressure is more anteriorly, now I'm getting a more, essentially more.
Because the trunk's coming anterior.
Keep center of mass the same. Everything looks the same. I'm just putting, when I'm pushing to go up in the squat, I'm just pushing more through the forefoot versus more through like the mid or rear foot. And so that more anterior center of pressure then essentially creates almost like a longer lever length for the hip and or calf to work with.
Okay, gotcha. So if it's more towards the heel, it's going to be more quad.
Yeah.
Okay, so now I'm picturing why it is that a sissy squat or a Spanish squat is so effective around the quadriceps, especially the further you keep that weight posteriorly and you're keeping shin angle vertical as you fall back into the band, why that works the quad so much harder.
Yep.
Okay, so that makes a lot of sense. How would you apply that concept to my Achilles tendinopathy or my Achilles repair clientele?
Like the constraints-based loading?
Yeah.
So I think you start to look at individuals who are going to start to offload that first ray quite a bit. Easiest thing I've found is, one, to use some sort of band underneath that first ray. Essentially, you're giving a light sort of pressure there. And if they lose that pressure on that sort of medial side, that band slides through.
Yeah.
I know they're not pushing through that medial arch. Other thing I want to make sure that they're also getting to is some of that slight inversion at the calcaneus. So I might use a ball there to try to help essentially get at that sort of inversion there, like try to finish that supination at the top.
And you would use a ball in between bilateral calcaneus.
Yep.
Okay.
Other things that you'll see people use for first ray might be using a slant board, but taking it to an angle. You might consider using both ways. I've seen some people use it where essentially they're going to start in a more supinated position and essentially their medial side is going to be the side that's higher. As you go up, essentially they should lose contact with the outside part of their foot. So now if they aren't pushing through the big toe, they're not going to be able to go up. You also see some people who go the opposite way to try to also encourage it as well. So that'll be more of like an individual difference there, or essentially understanding your patient to be able to decide which one is the best one.
And I see the same thing with a band around the midfoot, encouraging pronation or encouraging supination. Would you say it's the same way? And what have you seen work for you?
I have not gone with a band around the midfoot. That's something I'll definitely play around with to see what sort of response I get. But yeah, I think the big thing is like understanding like each individual is going to be different, and you might have one cue or one constraint that works really, really good for a bunch of people. And there's going to be this one person you try the same sort of constraint, and for whatever reason, they're not, you're not getting the desired movement kinematics or desired loading to the tissue that you want. So it's like, all right, what are some other ways that I can still, you know, be able to limit the number of verbal cues I give? And then some sort of constraint to now encourage the movement strategy that I want to see.
Because that is DST. Okay. So let's go along this train of thought. You have a patient who's just out of non-weight bearing. He's about to try his first bilateral squat. The one thing you have access to is a slant board. How are you using it?
First thing is probably like we kind of talked about earlier, I'm just going to observe their kinematics first. And then from there, if I see more of a hip dominant strategy, from there, I'm going to probably use the slant board, for a number of reasons. So
how are you going to use it?
So essentially I'm probably going to elevate the surface or some sort of like the plinth. So I just reduce range of motion a little bit. Especially like that sort of deep squat, acid grass might kind of piss things off initially if we just go from not having a bunch of knee flexion or having squatted to try to do like a full range squat. So maybe I do a partial range of motion squat there, but the slant board might encourage more of a more upright trunk position. You know, if they were non-weight bearing, now maybe lack some dorsiflexion, Maybe that's the reason why we see more of a hingy kind of squat. So maybe if I put them in relative more plantar flexion, maybe that gives me more access to that range of motion to be able to get more upright trunk. This is where I think things start to get kind of interesting here. So when we start talking about center of pressure, I think one way in which anterior center pressure might be more beneficial is when we start talking about active insufficiency. And when we, if we put the calf in a more plantar flexed position, I probably diminish its ability to be able to produce in terms of like that squat pattern. So at that standpoint, I think then anterior center pressure becomes relevant in terms of increasing quad loading because now the calf can't contribute as much.
Okay. Okay. So you're starting to take things away from the patient to get the desired effect. Gotcha. Okay. I got two questions around that. One is, let's say your same scenario, but you don't have a slant board. You have a foam roller and a wall. How are you starting this patient?
Same patient.
Their first bilateral squat coming out of non-weight bearing.
So now we're probably doing more stuff to address the trunk here. So let's say that I have that forward trunk lean. I'm probably going to go foam roller up against the wall, and then they're going to be up against the wall with their trunk there, and then they're going to slide up and down that with the foam roller. Let's say this person progresses really well. We get them doing a bilateral squat with pretty good proficiency and not a ton of like compensations. But let's say we get them doing some sort of a split squat stand or split squat movement, and they're really pushing through that rear leg. I might then put that foam roller, or put their rear leg on top of that foam roller. So now they have something that's kind of unstable, and they're likely going to push less through that. And we're going to get a little bit more loading through that front leg.
How quickly do you, because I would have thought, I thought you were going to say you're going to use the wall and give them a target for anterior knee translation. How quickly do you start getting into, no, let me have your knee push forward versus the wall sit, which I think of more so as a stepping stone to your Spanish squat.
So I think it depends. I know a lot of people don't like a ton of like into your knee or knee over toe early on, as that kind of might piss off the patellofemoral joint a little bit. So I would say I'm going to give it, you know, a few weeks of doing a little bit more like knee over heel sort of stuff. And then essentially with that sort of progression there, like with that wall sit progression, I can essentially keep them there and just work back the foot to get my relative knee over toe there.
Okay. Okay. That makes a lot of sense. Okay. And then my second question around this is, let's take your DST concept to change a direction. So an athlete, they're able to squat proficiently. They're able to do a concentric, eccentric, and both of those movements ballistically, I guess, in a box jump or some type of jump or hurdle jump. Now they're beginning to look at changes of direction. They can decel, they can axel, change direction. How do you set up constraints to get the desired outcome when they're moving fast? True Sports Physical Therapy is growing like wildfire. We have 14 locations, soon to be more. We are throughout the state of Maryland. We're in Pennsylvania, in Lebanon, in York, Pennsylvania, as well as in Delaware, in Newark and Wilmington, Delaware. Like I said, so many more practices to come, and we always need outstanding sports physical therapists. Our treatment style is unique. We are one-on-one with your athlete for 45 minutes every single session. You do the entire treatment. You do the entire evaluation, and they are in state-of-the-art facilities where you have room to run, throw, and jump, and really get your athlete all the way back to on the field and better and stronger than they were. We also have outstanding salaries, comp structures, bonus abilities, 401ks, as well as a very strong continuing education offering, including in-house continuing education. And we're looking for you. Now is the time, as we are growing like crazy. Just shoot your resume over to Yoni, Y-O-N-I, at True Sports PT, or shoot us a DM and we will hit you back. We will get you in for our unique, tried and true interview process and really make a determination that this is the right place for you to grow your career and get your athletes better than ever. We can't wait to hear from you.
So something that I've played around with, two biggest things I've used, especially when we start looking like at 5-10 fives and we have some of those 180 degree turns there where they have a more vertical shin angle there, trunk's more upright and not leaning as much in the intended direction travel after the cut. Some things I've played around with is, one is using a bungee to essentially pull them. I gotta think about this here. essentially it's pulling them into the cut faster. So they almost have something to be able to kind of counterbalance against and kind of lean into to try to get at more positive shin angles there in terms of back towards the other direction. The other thing I've been using too has been a ramp essentially to try to get that same thing where, let's say their involved side is the right side and I want to work on that penultimate step there. I might have them go down the ramp and then their left leg's gonna be the plant leg. So they end up turning 180 degrees to the right. And now that sort of the ramp here is now encouraging them to try to lean back up against the ramp there.
Up against it. Okay, yep. That sounds like the opposite of the bungee example, mm-hmm. where the bungee's pulling you into the turn.
Yeah, so essentially they're...
Now they're fighting uphill against the turn.
Mm-hmm. So I want them to be able to kind of feel like they can like kind of lean into that a little bit. Essentially, it's almost like a counterbalance. Well, if they have something to kind of push up against, they are probably more likely to lean into that direction a little bit further. It doesn't always work, but when I've done some like pre-test, post-test stuff, yeah. It seems to result in some decent sort of kinematic changes within the session.
That's pretty powerful motor learning, mm-hmm. right? Like you can do a drill at high speeds and then pull them out of that drill and try flatlands mm-hmm. and see if their movement pattern changes. Mm-hmm. I've done things where I would set up almost like a crossbar mm-hmm. so that they have to duck under, drop their center mass appropriately. That would be an example of DST, right? Mm-hmm. Where you're setting it up so that they don't have a choice but to drop their center yep. of mass. You just have to be careful that it's coming from the right fulcrums
yep.
as opposed to just a hinge, like a forward hinge, that you want to see that knee angle change, right? And
I think it depends on like what sort of compensatory strategy that you're seeing. So like, let's say you see that their center of mass is not dropping appropriately. I think that's like a very good sort of constraint to use. Like, hey, like essentially if you don't get this low, like you're going to hit your head on something. And it's something that you don't have to cue a ton, like the environment's going to create that for you. And then from there, it's like, okay, now I'm seeing X, Y, and Z compensatory strategies. Now that we've been dropping the center mass lower, once I kind of get proficient with the being more comfortable in dropping that center of mass, it's like, okay, like what other sort of constraint now can I use to be able to get at, you know, improved plant angles essentially.
Okay. Now, what are some of the dangers of using this DST concept? How can it go awry?
So I think the biggest thing is some people will use this as a crutch to not coach essentially. So there might be people who are like, oh, I'm just gonna let the individual self-organize. And that's their whole mantra is self-organize, self-organize. Meanwhile, you have this person who has this huge hip hinge and compensatory strategy after an ACL. And they're just like, oh, they're just self-organizing. And I'm like, we're not getting at the desired adaptations. Like we know we need to load the quad and you're just letting them do everything under the sun to be able to compensate around it. So I think that's the biggest issue I see is we end up using it or that sort of mantra of self-organization that we end up not coaching at all.
Yeah. And I'm kind of running into that with an Achilles repair now. He's about 6.5-7 months post and he is self-organizing well. So functionally he's coming along mm-hmm. in isolation. I know he doesn't have the plantar flexion strength mm-hmm. that he has, and I kind of have to do both. Mm-hmm. I have to show him that he is improving functionally. Mm-hmm. I have to prove to myself that, but also, is he making gains when isolated? Mm-hmm. So is that, because what's going to happen is, and this is the beauty of competitive sports, his opponent is going to put him in a position that he is not mm-hmm. functionally capable of. And that's when it's going to fail, right? And I think that's when you start seeing these repairs, whether it be ACL or Achilles tendon, when you start seeing them fail, it's because we have not prepared the athlete mm-hmm. to be in X position. Mm-hmm. So you kind of got to keep brainstorming around how do I put him in the position maybe that he can't own yet mm-hmm. and then drill around it,
yep.
right?
Other things I've been playing around with or like looking into, Derek Hansen, he had a great post, I think, yesterday, earlier this morning, essentially looking at how much the service impacts essentially force absorption and how we look at stuff from, you know, grass or wood chips on like when you're running versus all the way to concrete and how much of a difference we can have there in terms of force absorption based on the surface. And we start looking at like Achilles tendon ruptures in the NFL. I think there has to be something said about at least the surface or the changing of surface, maybe the different types of turf. Who knows if there's different types of grass that maybe have different compliance. And I think if we had some sort of like standardized, you know, surface there that had essentially gave everyone the equal amount of absorption, forced absorption there, I think we might see less in terms of Achilles ruptures.
Okay, that's really interesting. and totally applicable to the NFL, potentially an elite level sport. What do we do with a high schooler that's playing on grass, that's playing on dirt, maybe if the grass sucks, that's playing on turf? What do we do training wise to prepare them for that?
I think biggest thing is trying to give them exposure to a variety of surfaces, whether it's barefoot with a shoe, turf, whether you have like rubber mats that you can do stuff on, like what the traditional weight room setup kind of looks like. Maybe you have like one of those pads that used to do sit-ups on, have them do something there. I've seen people do plyos in like sandboxes and stuff. So I think just giving them exposure to the entire continuum of surfaces, I think we'll probably set them up for more success.
And don't forget about the wood floor, right? Because the basketball athlete, when they come to us, they live on turf, they live on rubber, but they're making their living, so to say, on wood. How much time are you spending there? And there's probably what to be gained by doing that, right?
I would say if you have the ability to be able to go to a basketball gym, I know Bethesda has like the hoops there. That's another easy, accessible sort of service that they can use to implement some plyometrics, pogos, running, change of direction stuff. I would say if you don't have that ability, you're probably going to end up putting it into an HEP to be able to like, hey, we got to get this many ground contacts essentially at the gym there.
Yeah, there's what to think there. What about footwear? Like I'm training NFL athletes in their turfs, right? Because they come in and they're on our turf. How much time are they in their spikes? How much time with a basketball player are they in their high tops versus their training shoes? Are those one and the same? How important that is that for you?
I think like when we start looking at maybe like a lacrosse player in season, like I know they're depending on like where they're practicing, it's either going to be turfs or cleats. Like I'm probably not going to do a ton of that within the clinic just because they're getting exposure to that outside of the clinic. So maybe now it's like if you have Metcons, like we'll do some plyos and some running and stuff in the Metcons. Maybe we're going to do some stuff barefoot just to give them a little bit of a different stimulus that they're not getting.
Okay. And is there a difference between barefoot training? I got one NFL linebacker that just lives barefoot. Like he'll do change of direction barefoot versus Vibram or barefoot shoes. Are those different to you?
To me, they're relatively the same. You might get a little bit more kind of force absorption depending on like the material and structure of the sole of those barefoot shoes. But generally speaking, I'm going to kind of lump them into the same kind of category.
Okay. So to sum that piece of the conversation up, you want as many different types of surfaces, as many different types of footwear that you can get, so that they develop kind of a Rolodex in their head of how to create force, how to absorb force, regardless of what they're on. Okay. The tremendous amount of value there in terms of what DST is, how to implement it appropriately. I think the big take home for the therapist listening is, one, there is a concept out there of DST. Two, how do we operationalize it? How do we actually use it in practice? And then some of the other sprinklings of these are different external cues, surfaces, footwear that can play a part in what it is we're asking the athlete to do. So it's like another form of DST. Dude, in this very quick snippet, you have taught me a ton. So I appreciate the knowledge. It must be the hours you spent preparing.
Oh,
for this interview,
I read way too much literature outside of
way too much. It's crazy. Can you give me an example of a rabbit hole in literature that has been detrimental to your practice?
Detrimental to my practice. I would have to say the biggest thing is when I start looking at like work-life balance, like it gets to a point where it's just like not even a specific topic. It's more just like I want to know more about a certain topic or a certain subject. Maybe I have some products I want to put together. And it's like, all right, I need to get this done by this time. I have all these articles I want to look at on this one topic. And essentially it just detracts away from like doing other fun stuff outside of like work and whatnot. And definitely some of that is like, I feel like I have to have the sort of sense of being busy and needing to do things. Heck, some of it might just be I read five different research articles to make, you know, a sixth or like a little 6-page post on Instagram about X, Y, and Z. I would say and this is kind of a little bit off topic, but I'd say like the biggest sort of thing I've been taking a deep dive into has been more like surgical technique in terms of like ACL rehab. And some of more like the surgical factors and how they're kind of implicated in like the re-tear process.
Dude, that's our next pod, right? It's got to be talking about what's the true difference between BTB and hamstring and quad. What is the true difference between LET with and without, and how that applies? How different is it with a meniscal repair? What the hell is an inside out meniscal repair? How important is that? Mm-hmm. And does it really matter? I think that's our next topic.
That we can talk about, like, tunnel placement, graft size, like you mentioned, like the inside out versus outside in technique, you know, where they're placing the portals, anterior medial, transportal, all this stuff.
And does it matter? That's what I'm dying to know. Does it matter? Does it change nuts and bolts of time to return to sport, pain levels, re-tear rates? I can't wait. I can't wait to learn that stuff. You're going to teach me a ton on that stuff. So, Race, thank you. Albeit somewhat abbreviated, this was tremendously helpful.
We are on Instagram at the_front_squat_doc.
Okay. And that's where you're posting all your stuff. Okay.
So, other place is at Rehab Renaissance. That's the only other place we're posting some pretty good content and quality content in regards to the rehab space.
Yeah. And just as a selfish promo, we want to hear from you. We want to know what you want to hear next. I think that's a great topic in terms of graft choice, in terms of tunnel placement. I think we'll get Dr. Hauser back on to talk about those things. But if there's anything you, the listener, wants to hear more about, find us, True Sports PT, on Instagram. See, that's very simple. True Sports PT on Instagram. Shoot us a DM with just some topics, or maybe there's a guest you'd love for me to have on, or a topic you'd love to hear me pontificate about. We're open ears. This podcast has been growing like wildfire. So thank you all for listening. Please share it with your buddies. Leave us a review. You can find us anywhere podcasts are listened to. And don't hesitate to reach out. It's True Sports PT on Instagram. Dr. Hauser, thank you for your time, dude.
Appreciate it, Yoni. Thank you. Man.
Thank you so much for listening to the True Sports Physical Therapy Podcast. Thank you for your support. We really appreciate it. You can find us on Apple Podcasts, Google, Spotify, wherever it is you consume your pods. We are there. Please give us a listen. Share it with your friends. Share it with your colleagues. Leave us a 5-star review. And as always, give us a follow on Instagram, on TikTok, where we are posting constantly, daily content on how to be an outstanding sports physical therapist. We appreciate you guys. We can't wait to hear from you.